Everybody, it's the With a Bullet podcast. I'm Matt Golden, and we're on to part five of our six-part series on the decline of alternative rock radio, the penultimate episode of the series, I guess. And for this episode, we're going to talk about Billboard's top 40 alternative songs from September 12th, 1998. I was still kind of shuttling in between Cincinnati and the Twin Cities, and they still had the same stations running in both places. The Edge up in Minnesota, which had changed their name to 93X by this point for some reason. And Channel Z was still around in Cincinnati, but that would only last for 17 more days. Channel Z ended up switching formats to top 40 on September 29th of that year. There was still 97X up in Oxford, Ohio. No relation to 93X in Minnesota, by the way. But like I mentioned in the 96 episode, you could barely pick that up in Cincinnati. I mean, most of the time, it wasn't even worth trying. So essentially, alt-rock radio is on the verge of dying in Cincinnati. I just didn't know it yet. But when I started out the series, I kind of mentioned that each chart was going to be worse than the one before. But I was kind of wrong about that. This one was just as bad as the 97 chart. I mean, sure, you had nu metal starting to seep in and the swing revival, but was any of that really any worse than a bunch of live copycats and third wave ska that we had in 97? No, I'm saying it's equal. If anything, the bad stuff is more interesting here in 98, but I'll let you be the judge of that. So let's just start it off here. And at number 40, we have Smash Mouth with Can't Get Enough of You, Baby. This one was from the Can't Hardly Wait soundtrack. There are actually three different songs from that soundtrack on this chart. And that movie is decent for a 90s teen movie. I'm not saying it's good or anything, but by 90s teen movie standards, it is. I mean, most of them were terrible, and this one was just slightly less terrible. Anyway, these guys struck gold in 97 with a song that sounded vaguely 60s, so, you know, why not try to strike gold again in 98 with a song that was actually from the 60s? This one was written by Denny Randell and Sandy Linzer, the same songwriting team behind The Toys' Lover Concerto and Four Seasons' Let's Hang On and Working My Way Back to You. This song was recorded by both The Toys and The Four Seasons in 65, neither of which was released as a single. But Question Mark and The Mysterians did the song a year later, basically just added like 96 tier style Oregon to what The Toys and The Four Seasons originally did with this one. And they did release that one as a single, and it was kind of a minor hit. It made it the Hot 100, but not the top 40. Smash Mouth's version is more or less based on that version, but the Question Mark version is 100 times better. Just trust me on this one. But this one did do better on the charts. It peaked at number 30 on here and went to number 27 on the Hot 100 Airplay charts. Smash Mouth charted a couple of other times with covers after this. They did Wars, Why Can't We Be Friends, and The Monkees, I'm a Believer. So like half of their charting singles were covers, in case you were wondering. And Smash Mouth will be popping up in the last installment, and the song that they have there might have something to do with Shrek. Just a little hit there. But at number 39, we have Right About Now, Funk Soul Brother. Check it out now, Funk Soul Brother. It's Fatboy Slim with the Rockefeller Skank. Fatboy Slim was the stage name of Norman Cook, former bass player of the House Martins. Group that was somewhat big in the UK in the mid to late 80s. If the alternative chart had existed before 1988, those guys more than likely would have made it on here with Happy Hour and Caravan of Love. But Cook was not a fan of like the jangle pop type stuff that they were doing. He always kind of preferred dance and electronic music. So the second the House Martins broke up, he kind of headed in that direction. He started a group called Beats International, who went to number one in the UK with Dub Be Good to Me. That song also topped the dance charts in this country. And then he started a few more short-lived groups after that. Freak Power, Pizza Man, The Mighty Dubcats, all of whom made it to the top 40 in the UK in the early 90s. But by the mid-90s, he was ready to set off on his own as Fatboy Slim. And this was the first single from his second album. It's based entirely on samples. The main one, the Right About Now, the Funk Soul Brother one, was taken from Vinyl Dogs Vibe by the Vinyl Dogs. And the guy saying it is Lord Finesse, who produced that track. And the track is almost entirely instrumental, except for the intro that Lord Finesse does, which was what Fatboy Slim sampled here. And Finesse gave Fatboy Slim permission to use this sample without actually listening to the song first. He just kind of assumed that it'd be like a very tiny part of the song and not like 95% of it. And because he signed off on the sample and he didn't get a songwriting credit, something which he regrets because he is like 95% of the song. But some of the other people who Fatboy Slim sampled on this did ask for a song credit or a percentage of the royalties before signing it off. And because of that, Fatboy Slim ended up making about as much money off of this as Lord Finesse did, which is fitting, I guess. He didn't make anything. But almost all of these other samples were from the 60s. Sliced Tomatoes by the Just Brothers makes up most of the non-Lord Finesse part of the song, but Dwayne Eddy's in there, Bobby Fuller Four's in there, John Barry's in there, a very early David Bowie track's in there. You get the idea. I kind of liked this one when it first came out, but I got really sick of it after a while. I was very surprised to find out that this sits peak on the chart because I remember hearing this one a lot. Fatboy Slim did make it a couple of other times in this chart with Praise You and Weapon of Choice. Probably both got on here because they're videos. But this is the last time he is going to pop up in this series. So say goodbye to Fatboy Slim. Number 38, Candlebox with It's All Right. What the hell was Candlebox doing on this chart in 1998? Anyway, since the last time we heard from these guys, they beefed up their grunge cred by hiring former Pearl Jam drummer Dave Cruzan, the guy who played on 10. So with him coming in, you'd think that these guys would have churned out some slightly more credible grunge here. But no, this is a ballad, and it's not like a Far Behind style power ballad either. It's just a regular ballad. It's pretty lousy, to be honest. And this was their last appearance on this chart. They broke up about a year after this. They've since reunited, but most of their recent tour dates are like casinos and county fairs, which seems about right for them. But anyway, number 37, we have Feeder with High. Another song from the Can't Hardly Wait soundtrack. And unlike the Smash Mouth song we discussed a little bit ago and the other song we have coming out from the soundtrack, I don't remember this one at all, but it's about getting high. The guy says in the song that he's going out for a while so he can get high. Isn't that wacky? But this was the only single from these guys to make any sort of impact on this side of the Atlantic, but they're shockingly huge in their native UK. They had 20 top 40 singles over there. I mean, who knew? I mean, aside from British people, obviously. I went and sampled some of their biggest hits from the UK, and they're just all as unfamiliar and as unimpressive as this song is. I'm kind of glad that they never made it here. But anyway, this one peaked at number 24. Number 36, we have Smashing Pumpkins with Ava Adore. This was the first single from their Adore album, which came out at the start of the summer. So I'm kind of surprised that this one was still hanging on 17 weeks later. Anyway, shortly after they put out this album, they had a huge free concert up in downtown Minneapolis. Why Minneapolis? I have no idea. I mean, they're from Chicago, so it would have made sense to do it there. But maybe they couldn't get the permits or whatever, so they had to settle for Minneapolis. I mean, who knows? But anyway, they estimate that somewhere around like 100,000 people showed up for this. I was up in Minnesota at the time, and I theoretically could have been one of these people, but it happened on my first day at my new job. So I kind of had to be there instead of like being up in Minneapolis watching Billy Corgan. And even though I was in the Twin Cities metro area, I was still like an hour drive away from downtown. I mean, I would have had to find like parking and all that other crap. It wouldn't have been worth it to see a band that I really wasn't into. But one person in the Twin Cities went the extra mile to be there that day. Her name was Pamela Keery. She was a 17-year-old convicted murderer, serving a 12-year sentence at the state's women's prison. And she heard about the concert on the radio, told her cellmate that she was going to see the Pumpkins, and then just hopped the fence. The corrections officers caught up with her a few hours later, but she did manage to see the entire show before she got caught. They didn't do anything to alert the crowd that there was like an escapee there, and the Pumpkins didn't know anything about it until afterwards. I mean, they just kind of quietly passed her mugshot along to the people who were working security until somebody actually spotted her in the crowd and they caught her. And obviously this was a huge news item in the area. I mean, almost bigger than the concert itself, which isn't really surprising. But anyway, about this song, this one is kind of industrial Pumpkins. It's their regular sound with like a Nine Inch Nails style beat. And they may have been forced to go into this direction because at the time they didn't have an actual drummer. They kicked Jimmy Chamberlain out of the group maybe about a year before this. So it may have been easier to reach for a drum machine instead of hiring a replacement or dealing with a session guy. I mean, who knows? But it kind of works. I mean, it's not bad. Kind of decent pumpkin song. But this one peaked at number three, and we're not actually done with the Pumpkins yet. We actually have the other single from Adore coming up later. Number 35, Sheryl Crow with My Favorite Mistake. Sheryl Crow popping up again in this series. I mean, who knew she was such a force in the world of alternative rock? This was the first single from her Globe Sessions album, and this song is allegedly about her relationship with Eric Clapton. I wasn't aware that Sheryl Crow ever dated Eric Clapton or even wrote a song about him. But anyway, Crow denies that it's only about him and claims that it's just a composite of Clapton and a few other guys. She used to joke that it was her version of You're So Vain, and used to say when people asked that it was just about Warren Beatty or Mick Jagger, which is the same people who Carly Simon would say that You're So Vain was about. But anyway, this is pretty typical Sheryl Crow. It's not great. It's not horrible. It's okay, I guess. It's still kind of a surprise that she's on the alternative charts. This one peaked at number 26. It topped the AAA chart. It was also a top 20 hit on the regular top 40. Amazingly, she was not done with the alternative charts, though. She made it one last time here in 1999 with her cover of Guns N' Roses' Sweet Child of Mine, believe it or not. But anyway, number 34, we have Better Than Ezra with One More Murder. I was very surprised to see these guys popping up here in 1998. This is sort of their attempt at going electronica or trip-hop. And this one is about as good as you'd expect a Better Than Ezra electronica or trip-hop track would be. I mean, which is not very good. It's really boring. I don't remember hearing this one on the radio at all. It only made it to number 32, which at the time was their lowest peaking single on this chart. And this one was also on the soundtrack of the X-Files movie, which I totally forgot that there was an X-Files movie. But they're on there on the soundtrack, and there are actually two songs from that soundtrack on this chart. And the second one is coming up right here at number 33, which is the Foo Fighters with Walking After You. This one originally appeared on the Foo Fighters Color and Shape album. And on there, it was more or less just Dave Grohl on his own with an acoustic guitar. But for the X-Files movie, they decided to go all out with a full band version of it. It's slightly better than the original, but it's just as wimpy, though. This was their second appearance on an X-Files soundtrack. They actually covered Gary Newman's Down in the Park a couple years before this for the show's soundtrack. Apparently, Dave Grohl was just a huge fan of Mulder and Scully. But the video for this is kind of odd for the Foo Fighters because it's their only video that seems somewhat serious in tone. And Dave Grohl completely loathes it for that reason. I mean, what good is it to make a video if you can't ham it up in it? I mean, Dave Grohl hams it up in every single video, but he couldn't do it here. And he was disappointed that he couldn't ham it up. But supposedly, it was originally supposed to have more of an X-Files type theme, and David Duchovny was actually going to direct it. But the company ended up bowing out at the last second because he admittedly didn't know what the hell he was doing. He had never directed anything before, and he was scared about screwing up a Foo Fighters video. But anyway, this one peaked at number 12. We're done with the X-Files soundtrack, but we're not done with the X-Files. Actually, the top two songs on this are somewhat associated with the X-Files, believe it or not. But anyway, number 32, we have K's Choice with Everything for Free. I very briefly talked about this song in the last episode because I totally forgot that K's Choice were going to pop up again in this episode. So I'm just going to repeat what I said about it there and just kind of leave it at that. So here it is. I thought that Not an Addict was their only hit on this chart, but their follow-up single, Everything for Free, also made it. I checked that one out, but I don't remember it at all. Well, there you go. Number 31, Monster Magnet with Space Lord. Monster Magnet were essentially a one-man band. Lead singer Dave Windorf has been their only consistent member in their 30-year history. Before he was in Monster Magnet, he was in an early New York punk band called Shrapnel. And the only reason that I know anything at all about Shrapnel is because Lester Bangs made fun of their gimmick, which was dressing up in army uniforms and bringing rifles on stage. I mean, one of his articles about the New York punk scene. I mean, that's really probably the only thing you need to know about Shrapnel. But anyway, Monster Magnet were a stoner space metal band, kind of equally influenced by Black Sabbath and Hawkwind. This song doesn't sound like either of those two bands. It's mostly acoustic. It's sort of jokey and bluesy. It really only gets metal on the choruses. The only lyrics in the chorus are Space Lord Mother, but I'm pretty sure that the second mother is supposed to be something else, maybe something starting with an F. Who knows about that? But this one kind of ended up being popular on MTV because it had a video which was either a spoof or an homage to Puff Daddy's videos. It's really flashy. It was filmed on the Vegas Strip. There's showgirls dancing around. There's a lot of fisheye lens action. Windorf is wearing a lot of like absurd outfits in here, like stuff that Puff Daddy and Mace would have worn. But anyway, that got out on MTV, but didn't really make it that popular on this chart. It only peaked at number 29, and they never made it on here again. Number 30, we have Mercy Playground with St. Joe on the School Bus. The Sex and Candy guys. At the time, Sex and Candy actually held the record for the longest run at number one on this chart, 15 weeks. And if you're alive in late 97, early 98, that's not really surprising, I guess. I mean, it was on the radio constantly. And it was probably worse up in the Twin Cities because those guys did have a link to the area. They're actually named after the playground at Marcy Elementary School in Minneapolis. And John Wozniak, who was the lead singer of Mercy Playground, actually went to that school when he was a kid. And I didn't even have to look that up because they mentioned it every single time Sex and Candy was played on the radio, like thousands of times. It was ridiculous. But anyway, the song is not Sex and Candy. It was still written by Marcy Elementary alum John Wozniak, though. I don't really remember this one being played very often on the radio. It's a little bit different than Sex and Candy. It's not like a loopy acoustic borderline novelty thing. He doesn't mention Platform Double Suede or Disco Superfly. It's more or less just a straightforward alt rock song, but it's not like a 1998 alt rock song. It's like something that would have popped up on this chart in like 94 or 95. It's not really that bad. This one did peak at number 8, which really surprised me. They would make one more appearance on this chart in 1999 with It's Saturday, which was the first single from their second album. But they haven't put out an album in about a decade. They are still together. They are part of the whole like alternative oldie circuit that I mentioned a few times in this series. So you probably could check out Marcy Playground somewhere if you really wanted to. But Anyway, on to number 29, we have Sean Mullins with Lullaby. This is the only Sean Mullins song that I and most of the civilized world have ever heard. He has had a handful of other hits on the AAA chart since then, which did sort of surprise me. I haven't heard any of these. But anyway, I was never a fan of this song. I usually changed the channel the second he started drawling about Dennis Hopper, Bob Seger, and Sonny and Cher. But anyway, this was inspired by a fan who approached Sean after one of his gigs in LA. And after a few drinks together, she basically just ended up unloading her entire life story on him. And that more or less became this song. She really did have parents who hung out with Dennis Hopper, Bob Seger, and Sonny and Cher, apparently. I couldn't find out if she actually like hooked up with Sean or anything, or it was just like a friendly chat. But anyway, he initially self-released this single, only pressed a couple thousand copies, but one of these copies ended up getting in the hands of a DJ in his hometown of Atlanta, and that DJ put it into heavy rotation at their station. There was a major label bidding war, blah, blah, blah. You know the rest of the story here. But anyway, this one peaked at number 9 on this chart, went to number 1 on AAA, and went to number 7 on the regular top 40. Number 28, we have Korn with Got the Life. We are finally in the age of nu metal here, and I am so happy about that. Korn have been around for a while. They're sort of a known quantity. I first remember hearing them almost all the way back when this series started. Wreck When I Was 7 out of Canton had their Chutes and Ladder song in heavy rotation for a while. And at the time, I wasn't expecting these guys to ever become stars. It was just like, oh, this guy's yelling knick-knack, paddywhack, give a dog a bone over the sound of bagpipes. That's sort of funny, I guess. It was a novelty song. I kind of thought of them as being like the grunge version of Jackal. I mean, that's how much credit I gave these guys. But a couple of years later, their Adidas All Day I Dream About Sex song ended up on MTV. And I was like, oh, great, another novelty song, except for this one isn't really funny. Great job, guys. And I still didn't think that these guys were going to get anywhere. It seemed like a total fluke that they even ended up on radio or MTV. But little did I know that these guys were actually building up a pretty huge following out there. Their Follow the Leader album ended up debuting at number 1 and sold 268,000 copies in its first week. At that point, I had never met a single person who even admitted that they were a Korn fan, but apparently there were 268,000 of them out there lurking somewhere. But this was the first single from that album. It has a vaguely disco-ish 4-on-the-floor beat, but aside from that, it sounds like every other Korn song. It's shitty. It was very popular, though, something which isn't really reflected in its peak position in this chart. It only made it to number 17, but it was all over MTV. We're in the age of Total Request Live, which was MTV's daily top 10 shit fest, and this video was a staple on there. It never made it to number 1. Almost the entire time it was on there, it was stuck behind Britney Spears, NSYNC, and the Backstreet Boys, but it was on there so long that MTV ended up retiring it so other bands had a chance at being introduced to millennial preteens by Carson Daly. It was actually the first video ever retired by TRL. Three more of Korn's videos would end up getting retired by that show. God. But I looked at the TRL retirees list, and it's like a collection of some of the absolute worst shit that ever come out in this time period. I mean, the most tolerable song on there is Tom Green's Bum Bum song, to give you an idea. But anyway, amazingly, this is Korn's only appearance in the series. I thought for sure they would have made it in the 99 show because they're just as stupidly huge as they were in 1998. But no, it's not in the cards for them. But moving on to number 27, we have Lenny Kravitz with Fly Away. I wish that I could fly like a dragonfly, so very high. I just wanted to be the billionth person to make fun of that line, because dragonflies fly maybe like 5 feet in the air tops. But anyway, Lenny's more or less phoning it in here. He did that a lot, actually. This one was a last-minute addition to his 5 album. That album was already finished and in the can when he wrote it. He was mainly just thinking about using this song as a B-side for one of the other singles that he was planning on releasing for the album. But he ended up playing it for one of his friends, and the friend was just like, Lenny, no, this song is a hit. Call somebody for the label and get it on the album. So he ended up doing that, and it was the fourth single from this album. I don't remember any of the first three singles that he put out from this one, and only one of those, If You Can't Say No, made this chart, and that one only peaked at number 39. This one did a lot better. Lenny's friend was right there. I mean, it was his only number one on this chart. It made it up there a couple months after this. It also topped the mainstream rock charts, and it was also his first single to make an appearance on the regular top 40 since It Ain't Over Till It's Over made it up to number two in 1991. Are You Gonna Go My Way probably would have also made it if it had been released as a physical single, but the rules were different then. But anyway, big success for Lenny, but this is still one of the dumbest songs ever recorded. And we aren't done with Lenny yet in this series. He is actually going to appear in the final episode with a cover song. Hint, hint there. But moving on to number 26, we have Marilyn Manson with The Dope Show. This one is about getting your rib removed so you can suck your own dick. Marilyn Manson rib removal jokes will never get old for me. But anyway, this was actually the first single from his Mechanical Animals album. He was going glam with that one. You could kind of tell with a really obvious homage to Aladdin scene on the cover of it. But this one basically sounds like Iggy Pop's Nightclubbing if it had like Spider from Mars style guitar on it. And Marilyn described it at the time as "We Are the World for Drug Addicts." Okay there. But he actually went in a different direction with the video for this one. He decided that maybe writhing around a filthy warehouse and weird like steampunk BDSM gear might not work for this one. So he did something with some really obvious references to The Man Who Fell to Earth and The Holy Mountain instead. Well, I mean, they're obvious references if you've seen The Man Who Fell to Earth and The Holy Mountain, which I have. But I'm sort of embarrassed to admit that I kind of liked this song at the time. I mean, not enough to go out and buy his album, but I never switched the station when this one was on. And this one was nominated for a Grammy for Best Hard Rock Performance, but it lost a fucking page in Plant, believe it or not. But it ended up peaking at number 15 here. Number 25, Local H with All the Kids Are Right. These guys are back with the first single from their Pack Up the Cats album. This song is about how fickle fans can be. They go to one show where you're kind of off and they write you off forever. Or as the song says, they won't wear our t-shirts now. Possibly based on their own experiences of touring after Bound for the Floor came out. Who knows? But this song sounds a lot like their fellow Northern Illinoisians, Cheap Trick. I think Illinoisians, the proper term there. I mean, I guess you could call them like fibs or flatlanders. But anyway, it's not as good or memorable as their previous alternative hits, Bound for the Floor and Eddie Vedder. But it's decent power pop type stuff. In the video for this, the two guys from Local H are playing a show, and they're actually playing every member of the audience in the video, and like all the security guards, all the roadies, the merchandise people, the sound guys. It's pretty funny, and it's was probably pretty hard to pull off and pretty expensive. I'm using 1998 era technology, but they had the Bound for the Floor cash so they could like pull that off. But this one peaked at number 20, and this would be their last appearance ever on here. And like I mentioned before, these guys are on the alternative oldies circuit, so you can probably check them out somewhere. Number 24, Sprung Monkey with Get Him Out of Here. I totally forgot about this one. It's like the worst elements of 311, the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones, and Limp Bizkit colliding. I'm not sure what genre this even falls under. I mean, I guess it's just crap. So moving on, number 23, we have Days of the New with The Downtown. Acoustic grunge. It doesn't get any better than this. They were from Indiana, from a town just across the river from Louisville. They're also essentially just a one-man band. A guy named Travis Meeks was the only consistent member of the group. And he could sort of tell that Meeks was trying to sound like an acoustic version of Nirvana or like Alice in Chains, but completely missed the mark and landed exactly on Nickelback. This was a couple of years before Nickelback, so maybe those guys were up there in Canada taking notes and going, yeah, we gotta sound exactly like this, but with electric guitars. But this one is better than their best known song, Touch, Peel, and Stand, but that's not really saying that much. The band ended up disappearing eventually because Meeks decided that he liked doing meth more than writing music, something which isn't really surprising for that part of Indiana. But this one peaked at number 19. It also topped the mainstream rock charts, and they did have a couple more hits on this chart somehow. Number 22, Dishwalla with Once in a While. I am amazed that these guys are turning up at this chart in 1998. I just kind of assumed that they vanished off the face of the earth after Counting Blue Cars or the Tell Me Your Thoughts on God song. But I guess they did get a chance to make another album for some reason. And this was the first single from their And You Think You Know What Life Is About album. And this might shock you, but that album ended up doing much worse than the album that Counting Blue Cars was on. It actually peaked 75 places lower on the album's chart. But anyway, the song is intensely bland. I'm just going to leave it at that. It only peaked 2 places higher than this. But number 21, we have Semisonic with Singing in My Sleep. Another follow-up single to a massive hit by a band with ties to the Twin Cities. These guys were from Minneapolis. Two of the former members were members of the band Trip Shakespeare, a group which dates back to the 80s Twin Cities scene. They put out a few albums on Twin Tone, which was the big local indie label. Both The Replacements and Soul Asylum started out there. But Trip Shakespeare kind of imploded after they signed to a major label, and they more or less metamorphosized into this group. Basically, all they did was hire a new drummer and change their name. But amazingly, this group's lineup was made up entirely of Harvard grads, something which I definitely was not expecting. The list of Harvard grads who ended up in rock bands is extremely short, by the way. It's basically these guys, Jerry Harrison, Rivers Cuomo, and Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine. But anyway, earlier in 98, these guys managed to strike gold with Closing Time, a song which was more or less inescapable a few months before this. It topped this chart for 5 weeks. It was also a really big hit on the airplay charts. One of the guys from Semisonic later claimed that Paola was a huge factor in that one becoming a hit. Supposedly, their record label shelled out $700,000 to make that happen. I'm assuming that one would have been played to death up in Minneapolis anyway, because it was local. But anyway, and that one was also the very last song ever played on Channel Z. So another little fact for that one. But this song was the follow-up to Closing Time. It's a lot more upbeat than that one was. It's borderline power pop. It's kind of driven along by like a Cars-esque synth line, something which was actually played by their drummer. He drummed with one hand and played keyboards with the other, which is kind of unique. But the song is about trading mixtapes, a very 90s activity, and the video is more or less based around one of these trades. And the band actually pulled their fans for the track list that would end up being used for the tape that was in the video. And the funny thing is that you could barely make out the track list in the video. But for the record, it's this song, Heart of Glass by Blondie, Can't Help Falling in Love by Elvis, Starmy Kitten by R.E.M., High and Dry by Radiohead, and Reception by Trip Shakespeare. I actually paused the video to figure it out for you people. So, yeah. But this one only peaked at number 11, even though it is a better song than Closing Time. I assume their label must have blown through whatever their payola budget was by this point. It was still on the radio lot in the Twin Cities anyway. They did make it back to the charts a couple times after this, which did sort of surprise me. At number 20, we have Seven Mary Three with Over Your Shoulder. These guys were from Williamsburg, Virginia. They met at William and Mary College, and they got their name from John's radio signal from Chips. I think Ponch's signal was 7 Mary 4. But anyway, they're best known for their hit from a couple of years before this, which was Cumbersome, a song that I can't stand. And based on what I remembered from their follow-up singles to that one, I didn't really have high hopes for this one when I saw it out there. I didn't really remember it, but I assumed that it would be horrible. I was wrong about that. It's not actually that bad. It's actually more or less just a decent Southern rock song. That's all you really can say about it. This one peaked at number 16. Not exactly Cumbersome numbers, but it's not that bad. They would make it back one more time in 2001. Number 19, we have Everything with Hooch. This was another band that formed at a college in Virginia. Though these guys went to James Madison, not William and Mary. I wish that there were a name for a genre that these guys were part of. It's like frat party, hip hop, acoustic, jam band blues, I guess. It sounded like if a dirty white University of South Carolina Cox hat became sentient and started making music. There were tons of these bands. They're faceless. They all seemed to come from the mid-Atlantic states. They all had some sort of novelty bent to them, and they all seemed to vanish off the face of the earth by New Year's Day 1999. Some other examples of this would be like G-Love and Special Sauce, the Fun-Loving Criminals who we had on here, and Soul Coughing. I mean, you might be able to lump Dave Matthews in there, but he was different, I guess. By this point, they had already put out one album on a major label and had been dropped, and that was about to happen again when Adam Sandler came to the rescue for them, or actually whoever was the music supervisor for the movie The Water Boy came to the rescue. This wasn't included on the soundtrack album, but it was in the movie, and enough people who saw The Water Boy liked the song where it actually ended up on the radio, and people started buying the album, which is why it's here. Shockingly, this was their only charting single. It's pretty horrible. But anyway, moving on to number 18 here, we have The Flies with Got You Where I Want You. The Flies were led by Adam and Joshua Paskowitz, who are members of the first family of surfing. Their father, Doc Paskowitz, was kind of a bohemian beatnik type who was obsessed with surfing and health food, and ran a traveling surfing camp slash surfing school. And he kind of had a dictatorial, like cult-like approach to raising his kids. They never actually went to a formal school. They're basically forced to surf all day, every day, which would be okay if you liked surfing. But anyway, the only food that these guys were allowed to eat was like multi-grain gruel, which was probably horrible. But anyway, they broke away from their dad and all that and eventually started an alternative band. And this song was featured on the soundtrack of the movie, Disturbing Behavior. And because of that, one of the stars of the movie, Katie Holmes, appears in the video. And in the video, these guys are playing on a cliff and Katie Holmes is behind them. And a bunch of guys are like trying to get her. But when they try to get her, they all just fall off the cliff and die. But anyway, I didn't really like this song at all back then, but it has aged fairly well. I mean, really, the only drawback to this is like the dopey 311 style toasting the intro, which is very 1998. But aside from that, it's pretty decent. It ended up peaking at number 5 here, but they never made it back. And they broke up after one more album and supposedly reunited in 2008, but I couldn't actually find any evidence of that. But anyway, this is it for The Flies, the last we're going to hear from them. Number 17, Brian Setzer Orchestra with Jump, Jive, and Wail, Swing Revival. Why did Swing have to come back? Why? Well, there was a scene based around like one club in L.A., the Brown Derby, and due to its proximity to Hollywood, it eventually made it into one movie, Swingers, which ended up becoming a surprise hit. And reintroduced swing dancing around the country. It kind of trickled out after that. Then there was like Squirrel Nut Zippers, who I'm actually surprised did not show up in like the 96 countdown. And occasionally you'd hear like somebody talk about taking like swing lessons, but it was more or less kind of like a cult thing. But then there was a Gap commercial. And this Gap commercial was pretty popular. It featured swing dancers dancing around a Gap clothes to the original version of this song, which was by Louis Prima, and it kind of blew up from there. Then he had this song, then he had a fucking Zoot Suit Riot and whatever the Big Bad Voodoo Daddy song was called, and it was all on the radio like practically like every 15 minutes, and it got old really quick, but thankfully this only lasted for like a month or two. Anyway, this ended up giving Setzer his first hit since his Stray Cat days, and his version is actually pretty faithful to Louis Prima's original. I mean, really the only difference is that Setzer swaps out a trumpet solo for a guitar solo. And this was actually the second revival for Louis Prima. David Lee Roth had a much bigger hit than this with his cover of I Ain't Got Nobody, Just a Gigolo, probably about 12 or 13 years before this. But it actually, this might have been Louis's third comeback. I forgot that the plot of the movie Big Night involved preparing like an after show feast for Louis Prima, but hardly anybody saw that movie. It's a good movie anyway. But anyway, this is it for the swing revival for us. Number 16, Eagle Eye Cherry was Saved Tonight. Eagle Eye Cherry is from Sweden. Eagle Eye is his real first name. It's not a nickname, by the way. And he's from a musical family. His dad's Don Cherry, the jazz musician, not to be confused with the hockey announcer of the same name. And his sister is pop singer Nana Cherry, who had a big hit with Buffalo Stance in the late 80s. But despite his family background, he initially wanted to become an actor instead of a musician. He came over to the States when he was a teenager and pursued an acting career. He did have a few credits, but it didn't pan out the way he expected. So he went back to Sweden, and a few years later, you get this. This was a true Swedish production, by the way. His backing band included guys named Lars, Nicholas, Bengt, Magnus, and Ingemar. And one of those guys even had like a last name with like the A with like a little circle on top of it. But anyway, this one isn't really alternative, but it did get played a lot on alternative radio. It's okay. It's pretty inoffensive. It's hard to imagine anyone actually hating this one. This ended up peaking at number 8. It also topped the AAA charts, and it made it to number 5 on the regular Hot 100. But this would be the last appearance that he would make on any Billboard chart. He's a true one-hit wonder, I guess. But anyway, moving on to number 15, we have Fastball with Fire Escape. Fastball were from Austin, Texas. They're more or less a one-album wonder. They had 3 hits off of their All the Pain Money Could Buy album. The Way, which was a number one hit on this chart, and then like 2 smaller singles, Out of My Head, and then this one. This is the only one out of those 3 that was sung by guitarist Miles Zuniga. And the main difference between him and Tony Scalzo, who sang the other hits, is that he's not trying his hardest to sound like Elvis Costello. It's more or less just light power pop. It kind of sounds like the Gin Blossoms. It's not that bad. It's probably the best one out of the 3. And the video for this is somewhat memorable. It follows a woman as she's getting ready for work, and she's kind of singing along to this song. And she's obviously a big Fastball fan. She has their posters all over her walls and like pictures of her with the band. But then, wait, is that a body under the bathtub? Oh shit, it's the drummer. Oh god, no, one of the other guys is under the bed and another one's in the living room. She killed Fastball. At some point, Pat O'Brien breaks into the video with a special report about the band being missing. Yes, there is a cameo from disgraced entertainment reporter Pat O'Brien in this one. Anyway, this one peaked at number 13, and this was their last appearance on this chart. They are still around. They actually put out an album this year, and they're still out there on the alternative oldies circuit. They toured with Everclear and the Nixons this summer, in case you were wondering what they're up to. Number 14, we have Pearl Jam with In Hiding. This was the second single from their Ye Olde album. The first, Given to Fly, was a really blatant ripoff of Led Zeppelin's Going to California. But here you're just getting a standard Pearl Jam song. I mean, there's really nothing special about it. It's kind of boring, really. I don't remember hearing this one very often on the radio. And like I mentioned in the 96 episode, the moment had kind of passed for Pearl Jam. This one peaked at number 13. We aren't done with Pearl Jam yet in this series. We actually have what's technically their biggest hit ever in the next episode. So stay tuned for that one. Number 13, we have Goo Goo Dolls with Iris. This was from the soundtrack and was inspired by the Nicolas Cage, Meg Ryan film City of Angels, which was more or less a remake of Wim Wenders' Wings of Desire. And it's written from the perspective of Nicolas Cage's character. It's more or less a straightforward adult contemporary ballad. I mean, there's really nothing all that alternative about it, aside from the fact that the Goo Goo Dolls were nominally an alternative band. But this was a gigantic hit. It was number one on this chart for 5 weeks, and it also topped the Hot 100 Airplay charts for a record 18 weeks. And this song's success on that chart, along with some of the other songs that I've covered in this series, like Don't Speak and Fly, actually led Billboard to change the rules for the regular Hot 100 chart. The rule when this chart was out and during the Goo Goo Dolls' entire 18-week reign on the Airplay charts was that you had to release a physical single or you wouldn't be eligible for the regular Hot 100. So even though this was a massive hit, technically it wasn't. But Billboard ended up changing the rules at the beginning of December, and this ended up debuting at number 9, which was its peak on that chart. But if they had changed the rule like a month or two earlier, this definitely would have been a number 1 single. The first chart after they changed the rules is really odd because 17 out of the 40 songs in the top 40 were making their debut that week, including a few songs that I'm covering this episode besides Iris. But this one also ended up getting nominated for Grammys for Song and Record of the Year, but it ended up losing both of those to Celine Dion's My Heart Will Go On. 98 was a big year for the Titanic, so the Titanic was going to win there. But we aren't done with the Goo Goos in the series. They will be popping up in the next episode, so stay tuned for that. Number 12, Dave Matthews Band with Stay, Wasting Time in parentheses there. This sounds like every other Dave Matthews Band song, so I'm not really going to waste any time on it. It peaked at number 8, and this will be their last appearance in the series, and thank God for that. Number 11, we have Hole with Celebrity Skin. This was their first single in 3 years. Courtney Love was busy acting in the interim. She actually picked up a Golden Globe nomination for the People versus Larry Flint. But anyway, Hole were back and they sounded a lot different here. This is much more polished than anything that came off of Live Through This. It's almost like it was played by like AI or robots. It's that perfect sounding. I know for sure that Hole's drummer Patty Schemmel didn't play on this. That was kind of singled out in the documentary about her as the thing that sent her into a downward spiral. That documentary is called Hit So Hard, by the way. It's actually pretty good. Courtney gets ripped to shreds in it, but she still pops up in it as a talking head, which is kind of amazing. The whole thing kind of drove home like how little you're going to make in a rock band if you don't actually write songs too. While Courtney was like off in Hollywood making like People versus Larry Flint and everything, Patty actually had to take a job painting houses, for example. But anyway, I kind of wonder what the other if the other members of the group were also replaced on it. It seems like they might have been. But this one was co-written by Billy Corgan. Corgan dated Courtney for a little while before she hooked up with Kurt Cobain. And it sounds kind of like a mix between the Pumpkins and Rumors era Fleetwood Mac. Both Hole and the Pumpkins covered Fleetwood Mac for singles a little bit before this. So it's not really surprising that Courtney and Billy would go there. It's actually a really great pop song. This would end up making it to number one on this chart about a month after this. And it spent a month on the top, and it was actually Hole's only number one on the alternative charts. And this one actually ended up getting covered earlier this year by Doja Cat. And it actually made it back on this chart. Her version peaked at number 18, and it's actually extremely fateful to this version, which really surprised me. But anyway, this is a good song, like this one. Number 10. Oh, yes. At number 10, we have Creed with What's This Life For? I was dreading this moment. I knew that Creed were eventually going to pop up here in this series, and well, here they are. This is very obviously Christian rock. They always denied that they were, but what could the repeated line, "We all live under the reign of one king," possibly mean? I mean, gee, I wonder about that one. But this one sort of surprised me because it wasn't nearly as bad as I remembered it being. I mean, yeah, they're right in your face with all the Jesus stuff, and they're very obviously imitating 10 era Pearl Jam, but they're also doing a really good job at imitating Pearl Jam. I mean, Scott Stapp's Eddie Vedder's voice is top notch. I mean, I have to give credit where credit's due here. I mean, there are worse songs on this charts. This was its peak on the chart. It ended up topping the mainstream rock charts for 6 weeks, which isn't really surprising. They will be popping up in the final installment of this with a song that is much worse than this one. It is much more overtly Christian. But anyway, on to number 9 with Third Eye Blind with Jumper. Another single from their first album. I sort of faintly praise these guys in the last installment, but I'm not going to do that here. The song annoyed me in 98, and it still annoys me now. That's pretty much all I'm going to say about it. This was its peak on this chart, but it did do better on the regular top 40. It made it to number 5, which was just one place lower than Semi-Charmed Life's peak, which sort of surprised me. But anyway, moving on to number 8, we have Fuel with Shimmer. This was the first single ever for Fuel. These guys have been around for almost a decade under various names. They initially started out in a small town in western Tennessee, but eventually ended up moving their base to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Why Harrisburg? Who the hell knows? But anyway, they finally got a record deal in Harrisburg about a year before this and put this song out. It's pretty generic mid-tempo alt rock. I mean, there's really nothing special about this one. It is way better than their big hit, Hemorrhage in My Hands. I'll give it that. Unfortunately, we are going to miss out on that song in this series, but this one ended up peaking at number 2 here, which isn't that bad, I guess. And they are still together, but with a different lead singer. They're mostly playing at like casinos and fairs like Candlebox are. And the guy who's saying this, Brett Scallions, or Brett Green Onions, I guess, was at one point the Jim Morrison and Ray Manzarek and Robbie Krieger's tribute band version of The Doors called Riders of the Storm. I can't tell if that would be better than being in Fuel or not. Maybe it is. Who knows? But anyway, moving on to number 7 here, we have Everclear with Father of Mine. Everclear again. This one is about Art Alexakis's a deadbeat dad. He ran out on the family when Art was 5. He occasionally sent out birthday cards, but he didn't really do that much to help out the family financially, and his family ended up in poverty because of that, and so on. It's all covered in the song. This one came about after Art had his own kid. I mean, he just kind of looked at his kid one day and thought, you know, why would anybody leave this behind? So he picked up his guitar and basically let out everything about his dad. Both Art and Everclear's label were somewhat apprehensive about putting this one out as a single because it was so personal, but they changed their minds once critics started singling this out as like the standout track for the album or one of the standout tracks. So they put it out anyway. And I wasn't really a fan of this one, to be honest, even though I kind of sympathized with Art. I mean, no kid should have to go through that. It still came off as kind of whiny. Maybe I just see it that way because I grew up with one parent myself. I mean, different situation. My mom died, but for me, it was like, yeah, your dad's a deadbeat, but I mean, at least he's still around. I mean, theoretically, you could work out things in the future. But it is a different situation, I guess. I mean, God, I'm getting into my own personal shit for a fucking Everclear song. I should probably move on here. But anyway, this one peaked at number 4. Number 6, we have Garbage with I Think I'm Paranoid. Another appearance in the series from the local favorites. Like Number One Crush, this was recorded entirely in Madison, Wisconsin here. Most of it at Smart Studios, which was run by the band. But they also recorded part of it at the rehearsal space, which was in an abandoned candy factory. And that place was home to a Mexican restaurant and a coffee place while I was living here, both of which I went to quite a few times. But both of those places went under during COVID, so that building probably is abandoned again. I mean, Garbage should probably move back in there. But anyway, this song was originally called Bend Me. They referenced the chorus to American Breed's Bend Me, Shape Me throughout the song, but they changed it to Bend Me, Break Me, incorporating references or like entire melodies of 60s and 70s songs into their own songs was kind of a Garbage trademark there. But I'm not really a fan of this one. It's not one of their best efforts by any means, but this was its peak on the chart. It also made it to the top 10 in the UK. They weren't done on this chart yet. They ended up having a handful of other alternative hits. The most recent one popped up in 2016, believe it or not. And they are out there still playing. They did a tour with Alanis Morissette last summer. They were both playing arenas and amphitheaters on that tour. So it's probably too big to qualify as an alternative oldie circuit thing, even though it's pretty much the same thing. But anyway, at number 5, we have Harvey Danger with Flagpole Sitta. Harvey Danger were from Seattle. This was basically their take on what their hometown scene did to mainstream culture. So basically, it's an alternative song that's ripping on alternative rock. But it might also be about jerking off. Maybe it's a combination of the two. But anyway, it was a big out-of-nowhere hit. The only thing that these guys are really known for. And their lead singer, Sean Nelson, had this to say about coming to terms with all that. He said, "If I died today and there was an obituary about me, it would run in a local paper and it would say that I was the author of this song. I'm okay with it, but I don't view it as an accomplishment. I view it as a strange fluke. And that fluke had nothing to do with how good of a song it is. That song for me has transcended quality. It's just bizarre and perverse. What I meant when I wrote the words and the melody doesn't matter anymore." Okay, then. But while they are mainly just known for this song, they did actually have a couple alternative hits after this. A cover of English Beats' Save It For Later and a song called Sad Sweetheart of the Rodeo, both of which peaked in the low 20s on this chart. And I don't remember either one of these, and they're both kind of lousy. But anyway, this is it for Harvey Danger. Number 4, we have the Beastie Boys with Intergalactic. The Beasties were no strangers to the alternative chart. They made it before this with Hey Ladies, So What You Want, and Sabotage. Hey Ladies was sort of a surprise there. Wasn't expecting that to make it to the alternative charts in like 1989. But anyway, this was the first single from their long-awaited fifth album, Hello Nasty. And there was a four-year gap between this and the previous album, Ill Communication, which at the time was the biggest gap between albums before for these guys. And by like 96 or so, people were just expecting something from these guys would be coming out soon. And there was a lot of rumors about why it was taking so long for it to come out. The most persistent one being that they bought a submarine and converted it into a studio and were recording the album there. I miss those kind of rumors. You really only got those in the days before everybody had the internet and could like look up to see if that shit was true. So you'd hear like stuff about the Beastie Boys submarine, Marilyn Manson's ribs, or about how like Tupac was alive and living in a cave in Hawaii. I mean, you knew this stuff wasn't true, but you also sort of wanted to believe the legend. Hopefully like Tupac's like still recording stuff in like his volcano cave. But anyway, the Beasties just recorded this in a regular studio, the same studio where they recorded the two albums before this. Intergalactic came out at the start of the summer and more or less met my expectations for what I wanted for a Beastie Boys single. It's classic Beasties. It's as good or better than any of their other singles from the 90s. It also had like an extremely goofy Godzilla, Mothra, Power Rangers inspired video, which I liked a lot. So I'm thinking, oh, wow, you know, if the rest of the album is anything like this, this is going to be an amazing album. And oh, God, was I wrong about that? I was pretty disappointed by Hello Nasty, but I didn't really want to admit it. And it wasn't like, oh, God, I waited 4 years for this crap and then, like, chucked the CD in the trash. It was more along the lines of, like, maybe I'm missing something here. And then I continued to listen to it for about 6 months before I, like, could admit to myself that it wasn't really that great. But anyway, this is by far the best thing on there. And this was its peak on the chart. It was also their first appearance on the regular top 40 since Hey Ladies. I was also kind of surprised that Hey Ladies made it to the top 42, but I mean, it peaked at number 28 there. It ended up winning a Grammy for Best Rap Performance, and they beat out Outkast, Rosa Parks, Uptown Baby, and Ghetto Superstar for that. And it also won a Video Music Award for Best Hip Hop Video. This wouldn't be the last appearance for the Beastie Boys on this chart. They actually made it to the top of this with To Check It Out in 2004, believe it or not. Kind of surprising there. But anyway, moving on to number three, we have the Smashing Pumpkins again with Perfect. This song sounds kind of similar to 1979, so they kind of took the logical step and went ahead and filmed a sequel to the 1979 video using the same actors. Well, most of the actors anyway. One of them was actually in jail when they tried to film this, so he ended up missing out. But in the first video, it's mainly just like high school kids just kind of goofing off, getting in trouble and partying. But now they're adults, and you have two of the kids living together. They have a newborn, and they both have dead-end jobs. The other couple from the video is in college. He's trying to get her to go to a Smashing Pumpkins show, but she doesn't get the message. So the guy goes alone and ends up bootlegging the show. And at the show, the Pumpkins are kind of in like full-on goth mode. And John Mellencamp's drummer, Kenny Aronoff, is filling in for Jimmy Chamberlain. I totally forgot that he was their touring drummer around this time period, and it's just weirder than hell. I mean, he went from being in the Hurt So Good video with like a bunch of like Indiana rural bikers and stuff like that to appearing in like a rubber shirt by Billy Corgan. The fifth kid ends up robbing a convenience store, the same convenience store that he vandalized in the first video, and James Iha gets to reprise his role as the clerk, and he gets even with this guy. I mean, he calls the cops. The kid runs off and ends up getting in a high speed chase. And the cops that are chasing him accidentally run into the kid from the first couple and presumably kill him. And that's the end of the video. Kind of a downer ending. Rest in peace, 1979 kid. But it's this was its peak on the chart. I always thought that this song was better than Ava Adore for whatever it's worth. Number two, we have Eve 6 with Inside Out. I alluded to the fact that our top two songs would have something to do with the X-Files, and I was not lying about that. These guys took their name from the episode Eve, which was a kind of a Monster of the Week episode, which involves like murderous clones that are part of some scrapped government program. But anyway, Eve 6 took their name from that. And these guys were from the LA suburbs. They're all still teenagers when they recorded this. Their label actually made them finish high school before they went in and they recorded the album. And the lyrics for this definitely seem like something that a teenager would write if they're trying their hardest to be wordy. But it ends up like coming off as pretty dumb anyway. But it's better than what Silver Chair were coming up with at roughly the same age. So I will give Eve 6 credit for that. But I wasn't a fan of this one. This is another one of those songs where I didn't really understand why anybody would like it. But still, a lot of people did like it. It actually had three different stints at number one on this chart for a total of 4 weeks. And we're actually between its second and third stints at number one. It actually went back to the top in October, and it also made it to number 28 on the Hot 100, and they ended up having 7 more alternative hits after this, which kind of surprised me. But their lead singer, Max Collins, has ended up becoming like a leading weird Twitter personality in recent years. It's not all weird stuff. He does like occasionally post some insights on touring, a record label nonsense, and the pitfalls of signing a record deal when you're a minor. But a lot of times he just tees off on late 90s alt rock. Third Eye Blind is a frequent target, but so is Eve 6 itself, and this song in particular, which he calls the Heart in a Blender song. And here's just a few examples of him ripping on this song. The Heart in a Blender song is crazy. What the fuck was I even talking about? It makes no sense. I'm an inventor. I invented the Heart in a Blender song. I should go to jail for writing the Heart in a Blender song. I don't want to live in a world where it's okay to sing a song about wanting to put a human heart in a blender. And lastly, you can't put a landlord's heart in a blender because they don't have hearts. But Eve 6 are still together, but they might not be touring. Max actually recently posted a sheet with their tour dates, which was completely blank. But he also made a joke about meeting Kanye West on the casino and fair circuit. So, yeah. But anyway, number one, we're to number one here. And, well, Chickadee China, the Chinese chicken, it's Bare Naked Ladies with 1 Week. This is just a novelty rap song. It's really annoying. I've never really understood why people like this one. But anyway, the verses and choruses have absolutely nothing to do with each other. Ed Robertson from the Bare Naked Ladies wrote the chorus first, and it's about a couple fighting. And initially, he was intending to have the rap in the verses match up with that theme, but he couldn't really come up with anything, so he just improvised what you hear in the song, which is basically just a bunch of pop culture references. So you get references to Aquaman, which he pronounces Aquaman, Leanne Rimes, Burt Kampfert, X-Files, there's the X-Files there, Akira Kurosawa, Harrison Ford, Sting, and Sailor Moon, along with a really weird reference to a small stadium at a youth soccer tournament in their hometown of Toronto, which is Birchmont Stadium, home of the Robbie, by the way. But it's bad. It hasn't really improved with age, but people in 1998 liked it.
this spent two separate stints at number one on this chart for a grand total of 5 weeks, and it did spend a single week on top of the regular Hot 100, which is funny because it's called 1 week, and it spent 1 week there. They have made it back to both this chart and the AAA chart a few times since then. They're still together, and supposedly they are working on something with Geddy Lee right now. I'm not sure if that's a joke or not. Who can tell? But anyway, that does it for 1998. We are on to the final installment next time around. And oh man, is this the absolute worst one? I mean, the ship is already sinking, but now the ship is like, with this one, the ship is like splitting in half and like racing to the bottom of the ocean floor. I listened to this whole thing yesterday, and it might be the worst chart that I've ever had to do in the entire history of the With a Bullet podcast. It is that bad, but you guys are going to have to wait for that one. So see you next time around. Bye.